Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, DX12, OpenGL, Titan Z, AMD Fire Pro, W9100, the truth about gaming laptops, and did you hear Oculus got bought? It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 260, recorded March 27th, 2014. Oculus Rifted or DX12'd? This episode of Twitch is brought to you by iFixit. You can fix it, and iFixit makes it easy with step-by-step repair guides, high-quality replacement parts, and all the tools you'll need. For $10 off your purchase of $50 or more, go to iFixit.com/Twitch and enter the code Twitch at checkout. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch Weekly Show that aims to bring you the best, the most important, most useful, most insightful, and delightful information about computers, laptops, and mobile devices like tablets. And yes, we even occasionally talk about phones. Joining us today, Mr. Scott Michaud from PCPro.com. Brian Shrout is out on extended family time last night with his old man, getting their golfing outing on, and we wish them nothing but joy this evening. Unless we don't. Scott, are you fully joy, or are you wishing Ryan the fateful shanks of the gods, to use a golf term I barely understand?
I didn't know how to respond to that.
How you doing, Scott?
Not doing so bad. Just set the bar as high as possible, so that when we fail to meet expectations.
Oh my goodness, it's all good. I actually had a chance to sit down and talk with Ryan earlier this week about DX12, which was the big announcement for hardware enthusiasts at the Game Developers Conference last week. Unless, of course, you want to count the OpenGL announcement to the Game Developers Conference last week. Essentially, DX12 is about efficiency. It's about very mantle-like lower-level access to the hardware. The API is still there. We're just going to make things function better. Are you excited about the DX12? And we should also point out that Mantle has what's going to be at least an 18-month head start in the market on DirectX 12. But, of course, NVIDIA was like, hey, we didn't do anything like Mantle because we were waiting for a sort of universal application. Why fragment the market even more when you could buy into what Microsoft wants to do, which is a convenient thing to say after your primary opposition in the marketplace has done something that you haven't. That said, they could be vindicated by their decision if DX12 ends up crushing Mantle. But AMD and Intel and NVIDIA were all on a stage talking about OpenGL and the efficiencies that they were going to deliver in terms of I guess more really about communicating with the CPU than actually increasing GPU output. I mean, how are you feeling about all of this? Are you excited to be a 3D PC gaming enthusiast right now, or just is it all just, oh goodness, just ship some games that'll actually take advantage of this high-end hardware?
Well, that's the thing about DirectX. I think that, and I think I kind of touched on this last week, mm-hmm. It seems like the majority of the reason for Mantle and DirectX and all these other systems is because back in the time when we had complex video cards of, architecture after architecture, things varied wildly. There was completely different data types. Now they're all standardized, so on and so forth. It seems to me like more of these APIs are kind of designed to make programming drivers easier more mm-hmm. than the performance aspect of it. I mean, when they're simpler to develop, you're going to get a lot of performance out. But one thing I didn't mention last week that was fairly interesting is that DirectX 12 and Mantle both offer the option of similar to OpenCL, where you can kind of query all the devices in the system and actually say, I want to do this there, this mm-hmm. there, this there. And one thing that was kind of popular is SLI and Crossfire to load balancing technologies. And they're designed not to be very, very efficient. They're designed to be like, we have twice of everything. Let's get some level of improvement over it. So they would do things like directly mirror the memory. So you have two cards. Each of them has 6 gigabytes. You're going to have 12 gigabytes total of 6 gigabytes of assets. That's identical between the two, like a mirrored hard drive, let's say. If you want to use those two cards to do different things, like one for compute, one for rendering, or one for a layer where you do rasterization, one for a layer where you do ray tracing for highlights, or one where you do a layer for polygons, another for voxels, or whatever you happen to have in mind, because it's your game, you probably know better. To be able to directly target each of them independently allows you to more accurately or more effectively use the resources you have. And more importantly, it saves NVIDIA and AMD from having to continuously make Crossfire or SLI profiles for your game to make sure it works properly, make sure it's efficient, and so on and so forth. So it removes strain from this guy and gives this guy more control. Mm-hmm. The only reason why you can't do it is if you can't do it, which is no longer the case, basically since, you know, about Fermi or Graphics Core Next when they started standardizing everything off. So I kind of see this as going both directions, and there's a lot of interesting things that can come out of it. It depends on which side you go from. From the consumer standpoint, yeah, you're going to see massively reduced latency in terms of giving your video card something to do. that actual action is going to take a fraction of the amount of time, and like literally fraction of the amount of time, not percentage gains, like, you know, whole, multiple, maybe order of magnitude difference of time. Mm-hmm. And then you see OpenGL where they haven't actually done that. However, you know, we were on a conference call and with NVIDIA, and they were talking about, hey, so this, we're going to talk about some other things about DirectX, kind of get a way around it. And they're saying that, I asked them specifically, they said, we're not commenting on that, but we're trying to make OpenGL be as close to DirectX as possible. And we hope that doesn't matter what API you use, they'll all have basically the same feature set. So at least there is hope that, so I don't put words in other people's mouth, of course, but at least there's hope that other people will start doing these interesting things like, you know, independent addressing of video cards. Because, I mean, even from the obvious standpoint, let's say you have a high-end video card in your computer and you have an APU that has its GPU turned off 95 for 99 or 100% of the time. That's kind of waste of performance just sitting right there. If you can, right, say, have a developer be like, hey, do you want to select that for physics? Good, right? Why not? And that's the point. Why not? Sure, your processor might not be able to overclock as much because it doesn't have as much thermal headroom, but you get an extra device. So it goes back and forth. But the main point, I think, is, and this is what they're not really talking about because it's not really sexy from a marketing standpoint, it seems to be more that it makes developing games and developing drivers and developing operating systems a lot easier. Like when I talked about this with NVIDIA, they said that the second most complicated piece of software in your computer, apart from the operating system, is the video card driver, because it basically is an operating system for their specific computer that's in your computer doing a specific thing.
Right. it's sorry, I was like grabbing questions out of the chat room. It's frustrating, right? Because I was actually, I can remember being in an office, one of the first really big stories I got to work on when I started working at Windows Sources about 1,000 years ago was DirectX. Right. It was 1995. It was DirectX. It was new. And it was mostly Microsoft's response to being really, really pissed off about all the strange things that were going on in DOS in terms of gaming and about sort of, you know, minimizing the number of things that were going to screw up Windows behavior, performance, stability, and standardized development for games so that a particular, you know, a gaming company that had a particular
Well, even back in the DOS era, have you ever remembered playing those games where it's like, I want to play a game. Great. Modify your audioexe.bat file to increase of buffers and, you know, allocations. Reboot, and then you can play that game. But if you want to play the other one again, maybe you should just kind of have a backup and restore the backup and then reboot again, and you'll be able to play that one, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they all kind of 30 and 30, if you remember those numbers, right. But...
No. I can remember hellish boot configurations and then trying to get out of the hellish boot configurations because you wanted to be your system to be stable at something other than that video game. And to that end, DirectX did a really amazing job of kind of leveling the playing field and making life simple for gamers. And that's a really, really good thing.
And developers.
And good point.
I'm sorry for kind of, you know, derailing a little bit, but I know how much you like audio. Vista did the exact same thing for audio. They've said that, what was it, like 70% or something like that? That's kind of a number on the top of my head, but there was like a vast majority of crashes and blue screens and windows were from an audio driver. And that was it. And when Vista came out, they were like, well, we're going to completely remove that. It's going to be all software based. And then it ended up being, I believe, now they can do, infinite number of sound cues and stuff like that. When just a couple years earlier, people were buying $200 sound cards because they want to hear 128 things at once for EAX 5.0 and other crazy things like that. You know, because we've been playing PC games for a while, we can learn about these sorts of things because, well, there's a camera pointing at us. So, but I mean, like they're doing the same thing with that. And I was even looking at the web audio API in web browsers now. And I was kind of playing around with it. And I was trying to find sound call limitations because, you know, I didn't think that they would have had any, you know, they'd be kind of stuck a little bit. So I played and I was going like 1,000 sound calls, 1,500 sound calls. I'm like, what is that? Then going to 2,000 sound calls, stuttering a little bit. I'm like, well, okay, so it's pegging my CPU, but is there any limits or anything? So I was talking to the guy on from Mozilla and IRC, and he's like, no, there's no limits. Right. We can go as much as we want as long as we have CPU power.
And that's what's funny is it's CPUs are so powerful right now. It's interesting because one of the things that came out of I want to say NVIDIA's panel at GDC was they were talking about how, you know, the performance curve for GPUs has gone like this over the last decade, and the performance curve for CPUs has kind of gone like this, or maybe more accurately like this. It's still going up, but it's much, much flatter by comparison. And, you know, we spent so long, you know, being so excited by new processor releases. The reality is, while the new processors are faster, the vast majority of the things we do don't actually consume any meaningful amount of processing power. I can remember, you know, when I built like the RIP Monster 3000, I was ripping and encoding, I think it was at 1.9 CDs simultaneously, and I got it up to like 7% of the CPU. And this was on a Core i7-920, right? So it was a fast processor, but it wasn't that fast. And the new processors are much faster and, by the way, much more efficient in terms of power consumption. You know, so, you know, I like one of the things that, you know, Mark T just bumped a bunch of things in the chat room. He says, Where did it go? I love the moment when the chat room scrolls by exactly when you look at it. But I think it was Mark T who said, you know, we want to see games that actually take advantage of 8 cores. And that's part of the problem is you look at a game like Titanfall. They didn't make Titanfall for the 10% of the gaming universe that has, you know, a Core i7 and a $300-$500 GPU or $200-$500 GPUs. They make it for the vast majority of gamers. What's the largest pool we can hit, right? They're probably looking at Valve. You know, the Steam has this incredible survey where they basically talk about who what the average person in the Steam audience is using the game with. And that gives them a really good idea of where they are, where the industry is going to be in a year or two. And that's why you're just now starting to see multi-core game development, right? Because multi-core, the game development starts back then. It's going to, you know, finish up there, and they want to hit for a game that'll play quite well on the majority of systems out there. You know, it's interesting. Trot points out in the chat room, I have a hard time seeing Mantle come out on top against DX12 in the market, especially given its restriction to only one of the two hardware camps. You can say the same thing for G-Sync. G-Sync's cool. It makes things pretty, but you have to have a compatible NVIDIA GPU and you have to have a compatible monitor. That's what one of the things Ryan and I talked about that made me laugh. Like NVIDIA's like, no, silly AMD. Requiring, you know, just this only works on AMD CPUs. It's like, or excuse me, GPUs. You know, it's like, hey, you know, NVIDIA, you do it too.
joke was DirectX 12 is industry standard, like everything else graphics related that ends with an X, right? Physics, no.
Oh my goodness. There it is. Molson 8 Drive Founded. If they can get games to take advantage of 8 cores effectively, then they'll get out money. It's an interesting thought, like the idea
and that's one thing that... Oh, go ahead.
No, after you.
And that's one thing that people kind of don't realize about, you know, multi-core development. And it's kind of a fundamental theory of it. It's not about how much performance you have. It's about how quick things get done. And the problem is that especially web browsers that are inherently single core because they made assumptions back in 1995 when no one seemed to care. And now they're kind of stuck with it. And if they change it, they break stuff, which is why Mozilla is going through this crazy amounts of research for Servo and Samsung's helping them and stuff like that. But when you see like AI overhead, it's not that, you know, DirectX and others people can't, you know, drop tasks to other cores. It's that the results need to come after that result. And then you see, if you look at the CPU graph for DirectX 12 a while ago, it was like one core had this much work to do in time, then this, and then this, and this. And the other one is a little bit more on each. There's overall probably a little bit more. Well, I mean, yeah. Whenever you go to multi-core, you're going to have more work. But the thing is, since it's spread out amongst more workers, it's done quicker. Therefore, it has less overhead, more time the processor can sleep, and other crazy stuff that happens.
Right.
You like, I was doing a demo a while ago, and people said, oh, your CPU utilization is crazy high, and or GPU utilization was crazy high. And I'm like, but that means literally nothing because it depends on how much time the process actually took. It could be 100% utilization done in 1 millisecond. You have plenty of time if it's, you know, per frame, which is 16 milliseconds or whatever. It's getting a little bit too hard in that. But I mean, people need to think of it in terms of doing your work in a time, and the less time you can make it take, either by spreading it out or just doing less, you're better. And this is what these guys are trying to accomplish.
Yeah, no, it's funny because I just dropped a link in the rundown. Puget Systems sent us a system to play around with for 4K gaming, right? We were talking before we started recording about the unbelievably beautiful the Asus PQ321 Q, which is like a 31.5-inch 4K desktop gaming monitor. You've heard Ryan talk about it. Now I understand why Ryan's like, wouldn't they pry my cold, dead fingers from it? Because it's an amazing experience. Vast majority of games don't support 4K, but when you get one that does, like Civ 5, everybody walks up to the machine, and 80% of them walk up to the machine, and their jaws drop when they see the amount of detail that's going on. And that's one of the only areas, you know, when you get to 4K gaming, all of a sudden you need all of the GPU and all of the cores because you're pumping out a huge amount of graphics information in your monitor. 1080p monitors just aren't stressing things that much, but there are ways to make things work better or make things work better for mobile, which brings us to our next door, which is OpenGL is ready now. You know, GDC 14, NVIDIA, AMD, and Intel discuss OpenGL speedups. And this is crazy. If you want to geek out, this is a 130-slide presentation. They've got a link to it off of PCPro.com. You know, and AMD, NVIDIA, and Intel all basically are telling OpenGL developers how to make their applications run more efficiently. OpenGL 4.2, and look at some of the cross-vendor extensions. Quote, a handful of known tricks can reduce driver overhead up to tenfold and increase performance up to 15-fold. This is, you know, again, the kind of thing that Mantle and DX12 are working for. And I should probably stop talking because you wrote this article, so you know it a lot better than I do.
Yeah. There's a couple of things, actually, about that. The first one is that if you go a little bit further down that page, there actually is a video from Steam Dev Days, which is a Valve kind of no-press event that they were just game developers talking to each other. And it's a hour-long presentation. Yeah, a bit further? There we are. Where it's a guy actually going through certain... it's an hour long, like I said, but... the guy going through certain nerdy details and code and that sort of thing to explain how you can get certain situations optimized better than others and stuff. And the main thing about this 130-slide presentation that they're trying to get through, and I know they're trying to get it through because they repeated that slide 3 times in a row, identical with different fonts. They changed only fonts and repeated itself each time. Is that this is now. This is not a future API. This is not, you know, DirectX 12 is coming. It's not Mantle is here, but it's, you know, limited availability because you have to be in their little partners to get the library to link off of it. It's in the specification right now. I mean, there are some extensions that are vendors, but they're multi-vendors. So, I mean, if you use a common, you know, probably mostly AMD, Intel, or NVIDIA. Yeah, that's it. That slide was repeated 3 times.
funny, yeah, that works.
Yep. And they have cool jokes. Because again,
remember these OpenGL APIs. Remember these OpenGL APIs.
They're basically saying, remember, this is now. This is not, oh, we're going to do something in the future. This is now. You can get almost zero driver overhead by doing certain tricks here. And they even have AMD and Intel in some cases, and NVIDIA in some cases, saying, like, this tricks work best with our vendor, but if you want help for this vendor, you can do this one instead. Or other things like that to keep it neutral. It was kind of funny how the three of them were kind of coexisting on a stage without somehow, you know, red, green, and blue without everyone looking red, you know? Not killing each other somehow.
Hating each other. Well, it's also, and OpenGL, of course, you know, it's not just, you know, desktops, it's mobile devices. And I think that's where OpenGL starts to get really, really interesting moving forward.
And again, they want, like we were talking about last week, they want to move ES right up to OpenGL kind of like an on-ramp. So soon we're going to see the mobile version of graphics processors be the same as the desktop versions, albeit slightly less performance, right? I mean, NVIDIA kind of jumped the gun when they're saying, oh, our new upcoming Tegra K1, I think it's called, has full OpenGL support. That's the way Kronos wants everything to go very, very soon, right? So
it's funny how that works.
But I mean, NVIDIA obviously has a jump on them because, well, they have made desktop graphics parts for a while. They have all the patents they need and all the technology they need to go for. It's just a matter of fabricating it. Whereas some other people might need a little bit of an on-ramp to slowly creep up to the features where they can actually keep up with AMD, NVIDIA, and increasingly Intel. Intel is actually doing quite a lot to look like a graphics company these days. It's kind of interesting.
Or frightening if you're AMD and NVIDIA. Because if Intel can finish kind of getting up to speed on this, and they're still obviously a way behind the high end, but I think at this point, you know, everybody in management at AMD and Intel is like, AMD and NVIDIA are praying that 4K gaming becomes the norm before Intel catches up on GPU performance. I could be oversimplifying.
There's one hilarious thing that happened a while ago. So this is a while ago news, so it's not in the rundown, but Xeon Phi is a Intel's kind of GPU equivalent. It's technically a really, really, really high core count, very wide thread, so you have a lot of vector components. So you can do a lot of things per operation. You have a lot of operations you can do at once. And they're able to get up to, in the targets for 2015, they say 6 teraflops, which is a little bit higher than a Titan, single precision and 3, which is higher than anything right now, double precision, with their GPU equivalent. And the weird part about it is that it will actually be both add-in card as well as socketed. So you can actually have a video card based thing, be your bootable processor in your computer. Because it's an x86 based based on Silvermont. So if you're doing something like a web browser where it's single thread, you're going to feel like you're using an Atom. But if you're starting to do stuff that can scale across multiple cores and you use the correct way you can schedule it basically across the processor, you're going to start seeing like people in Tim Sweeney from Epic Games have been saying since like 04, we're going to start seeing CPUs and GPUs merge. And it's not so much that they're merging as much as it is that they're becoming very generalized. And now it's becoming more of a, I want to run this. Find who's best. So I find it kind of interesting that you're able to now boot an operating system with a video card, which has performance and single thread. But
well, it's got to start somewhere. I mean,
exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, while we're talking about performance and insanity, we should probably mention GTC 2014, which is essentially NVIDIA's private sort of it's their Intel Developers Forum. It's their IDF. The new dual GK110 GPU, the GTX Titan Z graphics card. And there's a really big picture of the graphics card. And then you scroll down a little bit. and you see the Google Brain and the Stanford AI Lab. And the Stanford AI Lab is one Titan Z accelerated server, three Titan Zs equals 17,280 cores, 2 kilowatts, $12,000. The Google Brain is 1,000 CPU servers, 2,000 CPUs equals 16,000 cores, 600 kilowatts, $5 million. And what's crazy about this is, one, these are pretty efficient cards, and two, these are unhinged. These are $3,000 GPUs. They are $3,000 supercomputers. Might be a way of making it more palatable, because I know people in the chat room are like, what? GTX Titan Z, triple slot graphics card, two full GK110, big old Kepler GPUs. That's 5,760 CUDA cores, 448 TMUs, 96 ROPs, 12 gigabytes of DDR5 memory on a 384-bit bus. Holy crap.
So basically what they're saying is, we're going to take two Titans, stick them on one board, charge three times the price, which... say what you like about that. I'm not going to get much into that. And
let it go.
That's what you have, right? So there gets to be some pros and cons with that. I haven't done stuff recently with it, but from what I understand, dual chip video cards are actually two separate devices. So if you're doing OpenCL or other types of programming, it's not like you can just address them all at once. You actually have to manually split your task and then give them to separate devices. So if you're looking to have two, I think you're probably better off, like, just have two cores. I think you're probably better off getting two Titans instead of, or two Titan Blacks instead of one of these Titan Zs.
For normal human beings, it might be better to buy a couple of Titan Blacks. For people who are trying, it's kind of funny.
For normal human beings, I wouldn't even say Titans. But yeah. I mean, normal, if you're,
buy a nice used car. You pay your rent for several months. But, well, it's funny, right? Because it's a very specific design where they're like pulling air through the card, pushing it out through the vents at the front. It's a very, it is a beast created for a very specific set of applications, none of which include home desktop gaming. Although I'm sure somebody somewhere is trying to figure out how to buy one right now so they can have it in their machine at home.
But like, the thing is, I haven't talked to NVIDIA about this, so I could be completely wrong. Mm-hmm. I don't see any use case for this unless you want to have more Titans in your computer than your computer can physically mount. If you physically can mount the equivalent amount of Titans, you'll probably save money. And I can't think of any situation where that not be the case. And that's kind of the part that doesn't exactly kind of make sense to me. So, I mean, it's great if you want to have, I think they support up to three of them, so that'd be six video cards in your computer.
Right.
And my internet just went crazy.
I'm just thinking about the power consumption and the fact that you'll be able to heat a small apartment with that. Let's take a moment to move on to the Jetson TK1 mobile CUDA development platform. Tim Berry wrote this up for PC Per. NVIDIA recently unified its desktop and mobile GPU lineups, which is a big deal, by moving a Kepler-based GPU in its latest Tegra K1 mobile system on a chip. What do you think, man, of Jetson?
Okay, well, the thing with Jetson is, it's a good development platform for TK1 or for Tesla K1. Mm-hmm. I don't really know much more about it, except that it's, I mean, if you're the type of person that wants to like hack with a Raspberry Pi, but you'd want something significantly more powerful and you're not afraid to pay like $200 for it, then this would probably be a interesting option for it. I'm growing increasingly concerned of what's going on with my, you know, video card, but whatever, or my video, but anyway. So
it looks good from here.
Beyond I probably don't really know enough about this to actually, you know, give it a good
I mean, it was interesting. Like, one thing they point out in the article is Audi's apparently been using the TK1, the Jetson development board, to power its self-driving prototype car, robotics, medical devices, security systems. It's kind of an interesting concept, right? It's $200 compared to, you know, Raspberry Pi. $200 is a lot compared to what it would have taken to get this kind of computational power 2 years ago. $200 is starting to look actually kind of cheap. You know, I mean, it's not a huge 192 CUDA cores, the equivalent of 360 gigaflops, and the VisionWorks SDK. Is it more? It seems like it's more about visual processing than anything else. Certainly,
well, it's a development platform, and certainly when you're dealing with a GPU, the first thing you're going to think about is visual processing, and you're going to have use cases of, like, you're driving down a road and you have a camera feed and you want to be able to identify objects. Well, that process is very computationally intensive, but hey, can be split up into multiple different chunks. Hey, what is a video card good at, right? So, I mean, you're going to end up with that sort of thing. I think it's more just that they want to have a development platform for people to use for whatever they can. Of course, the first ones are going to come in, it's going to be like that, but it's going to be visual, like I said. But I mean, yeah. Now, of course, the concept of using mobile devices with high-end video cards is interesting, not just from a tablet or whatever standpoint. You can stick them in cars and use it for its logic. You can stick them in any number of things to have. And this is the thing that's difficult with these development platforms. They put them out there and be like, what can you create with them? If it was so easy for them to, you know, toss them out, it's kind of hard for me to then go and say, well, there's this set of features for it, because no one really knows yet. And that's the problem. Right. So, I mean,
it has yet to be invented.
And that's the thing. This is what these are for. It's like, here, what can you do that's worth $200 that needs this much performance? Let's see.
I think it's going to be interesting to watch. It's funny. It's not funny. It's serious. It's kind of amazing when you start realizing, you know, my daily drivers, you know, two of them have minimal computational power, and it's entirely controlling basically the fueling system, the fuel injection system. You know, I have one OBD2 car, so obviously it's doing a tremendous amount of monitoring. I have two cars that are basically mechanical for all intents and purposes.
Yep.
You know, pretty much borderline, like, you know, end of the world, nothing else in the universe will start, but at least my truck will start. And you start looking at the idea of you know, the timeline for the automotive industry is, you know, high-end cars are going to have assisted driving by like 2017. It's going to be pretty common. Like 2020, it's going to be on inexpensive cars. And self-driving automobiles, autonomous vehicles, you're looking at, like, I think 2025 at the high end. You know, and it's an interesting thought. Like, hey, maybe NVIDIA's future isn't going to be tablets, and it's going to be, you know, crazy visual computing applications inside of things like automobiles. It's an interesting thought for the future.
And no one really knows, because, again, yeah. Raspberry Pi, when it came out, it was a small computer for people to do educational applications with. Who uses it for educational applications these days, right? I've even seen people attached to a weather balloon to control a camera just for the hell of watching something fall, you know, 10,000 feet. That's, you know, cheap enough that they don't mind if it breaks on the way down, right? So we don't know where this is going to end up. I mean, cars are a good direction, because if you have something that costs $200, well, there is plenty of things that cost $200 in a car. So if they add one more, it's not going to really affect the price too much. And if they can get a feature that doesn't affect the price a lot, then, hey, they're getting a big net gain, right? So
I think we'll see where it goes. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I actually am going to get to take a drive in someone's Tesla Model S later on this evening. So they're picking me up to go grab some food. And it's kind of funny. Like, the original Tesla, while very sophisticated, didn't have, you know, the giant, you know, computer in the dashboard and computerized gauges and everything. So I think it's going to be one of those interesting moments where it's like you're feeling very close to the future, and it'll be very interesting to see how much of this pushes down into affordable automobiles in the next couple of years. Moving away from the affordable thought there for a moment, Asus ROG, Republic of Gamers, Poseidon GTX 780 graphics card review. Maury wrote this up for PC Purr. That looks like water cooling built in. Am I wrong about that?
Yep, so that's pretty. What Poseidon's all about, because Poseidon is like the Greek god of water or something.
Yes.
The
sea.
Yeah. They have a big line of ready water cooled devices, and this one was for a video card. And, you know, GeForce 780 is not really that problematic when it comes to heat, not compared to other cards that have been released recently, but if you can drop a little bit of temperature off it, maybe you can get some clocks a bit higher, right? And that's how things work. So, Maury went over and looked at it and gave it some testing. Ended up giving it a gold award, but I'm trying to find some good benchmarks here.
I'm just still obsessed with that row of beautiful, beautiful capacitors on the board. 10-phase super alloy power along with acclaimed Digi Plus VRM. It's like, you know, I just like seeing completely ridiculous power solutions. Possibly utterly necessary, possibly delightful, but it's like looking at high-end audio gear when you see, you know, they're spending measurable amounts of money on capacitors. It's like, oh, they're pretty. Oh, I bet they're really, really expensive.
Yep. Well, again, you want to have good energy in to get your overclock high, right? So,
right. And, you know,
it's
for
a good
$600.
Thing to give it.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. No good.
I was going to say, for $600, you should get shiny capacitors and superior cooling, but, yep. And it's a pretty card. I've been thinking about that because I've been staring at these two beautiful AMD cards inside this big giant box for the last 2 days. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Liquid cooling. Suddenly liquid cooling is important to me again. Just because it's really, really pretty and because it dissolves a lot of heat. We take a moment to thank our sponsor, iFixit.com/twit. Enter the code TWITS to save $10 off a $50 purchase. You've heard us talk about iFixit. I have spent a lot of quality time with iFixit over the years because I don't like to break iPhone screens. It just happens. Matter of fact, you can see, there it is. There's a big hole in the corner where my screen should be. If I was smart, I'd go to iFixit.com and order the replacement parts and take advantage of the amazing iFixit guides. And while they kind of started out as an iPhone, iPod, Mac repair shop, they are all about trying to repair everything at this point. They're like the free online repair manual for everything. The step-by-step repair guides are free. They are foolproof. They walk you through every single step of making a repair. Shattered your laptop screen, need to repair a game console, swap the battery in your tablet or your smartphone. iFixit has got you covered. Like 10,000 repair guides from everything from electronics, like we were just talking about, home appliances, clothing, even your bike. And they've got a good selection of parts that you'll need to fix it. Everything they sell is tested and guaranteed. They also make really, really good repair tools. We actually have one of the ProTech toolkits here at TechZilla, and it's one of the early ones. It came in a plastic box. Didn't come with a really, really cool tool roll they use now, but there are 70 tools to help you get through any mod, malfunction, or misfortune that comes your way. It is a gold standard for electronics work. Garage hackers, the CIA, the FBI, and other three-letter agencies are buying these toolkits to make their lives easier. You know, these are the tools that are used by repair technicians everywhere. And I think somewhere in there, if we get away from the lovely iFixit video or somewhere in there, it is. Oh, wait a minute. There it is. The 54-bit driver kit. We use this constantly on TechZilla. 54 standard, especially in security bits, Phillips bits, Pentalobe bits, the irritating stupid screw that Apple came up with to try to keep me from fixing my phones, Torx and Torx security bits, Tri-Wing bits. Those are the ones that are using video game consoles. And they even have the legendary triangle bit you need to repair McDonald's toys. This kit has a bit for everything. It's a swivel top screwdriver that's really nice. It's an incredible collection of spudgers and tweezers that come inside the box. They got a flex extension to help you get to really awkwardly positioned screws. ESD safe precision tweezers. And for those of you who are better than I am, there's an anti-static wrist strap to help keep your devices safe from accidental static discharge. Apparently, particularly good idea if you're working on Arduino projects. It's $70 for an incredible collection of tools. It's backed by 1-year warranty. And it's not just for electronics, doorknobs, eyeglasses, cabinet doors, sinks, fixtures, little tiny plastic bits you need to glue back together to keep your children from weeping about a lost toy. Listen, people, with iFixit, you can fix it yourself. Visit iFixit.com/twit for free step-by-step guides. iFixit also sells every part and tool you'll need. Plus, if you enter in the code TWICH, that's T-W-I-C-H at checkout, you'll save $10 off any purchase of $50 or more. That's iFixit.com/twit. Use the offer code TWICH. You will save money and get a great set of tools or great parts you need to repair your devices. I like their tools. They do a really good job of thinking through what you need, what you don't need, and making sure you get good quality. And we want to thank iFixit for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Good stuff, people. Oh, my goodness. Corsair Obsidian 450D Mid-Tower Case Review. I have not seen this case unless I saw it. Listen, it all bleeds together. CES is kind of this sort of terrible... I was keeping another thing. There's all this shiny stuff I saw at CES, and Lee wrote this up, Robotech. This is a relatively understated case for the 21st century, even if it does have a giant window on the side.
Yep, so, there's a... I mean, the thing with Corsair that people keep talking about is that they, like... I'm not even sure if I mentioned it last week or not, but they tend to look at their products and they start saying, so how can we, you know, serve customer demands and make things kind of cheaper? And where can we sacrifice a little bit here to make these stuff there? And you end up seeing where they create products that are really well thought out. Well, I don't know too many details about the case. I do know that Lee, who usually does our case and power supply reviews for us, seems to like it quite a bit. He does say that he misses a bit of the, quote, robust fit and finish of the classic 650D mid-tower enclosure, and that there's no external hot swap for 3.5-inch hard drives. But... everything else he seems very, very happy about. Good cable routing, tool-free
dust filters, which I'm in love with removable dust filters. I have one case now that has removable dust filters, and they have not changed my life. I will not say they have changed my life. That would be ridiculous, but it really makes it easier to keep the filth out of the inside of your case.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And that's going to be $120 available in April 2014. Scott, what's the story? So the AMD FirePro W9100, this sounds like it's going to be a workstation level GPU.
Yep. So you guys know about the R9 290X, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Well, imagine that with a professional, like, take an R9 290X, say, no more Bitcoin for you, then say, put on a tux, go to work, you know, maybe a smoking jacket or some other, you know, business casual or, you know, business formal attire, and go make something in your life. And that's what this guy is. So basically, it is a Hawaii GPU that, you know, has... similar graphics performance. I don't remember if AMD limited double precision performance of their R9 290. I think they did, though. But this one's not limited. It's full performance for that. So if you're looking for a compute card, if you're looking for a card that's good in Maya or in 3D Studio Max, is this one Blender. Photoshop and Premiere is the other guys I was thinking of, because for some reason I couldn't think of those immediately. Then this guy... is going to be AMD's offering for that. One interesting aspect of it is that it's, I believe it's a dual slot card. Yeah, it's a dual slot card, of course. AMD is supporting 4 of them in a computer. So they're actually going to be partnering with vendors to allow up to four of these to be installed and shipped as a workstation as a whole, plus an extra PCI Express slot in case you want, you know, an PCIe SSD, because yeah, for a graphics card, might as well have something else in there, or an SDI input card or whatever. But each of these is capable of doing either six 4K displays or three 4K displays at 60 hertz. So you're talking about four supported cards, three 60 hertz 4K displays each. And they're saying it does multiply, so you can technically have a workstation which can drive, you know, 12 4K 60 hertz displays at, you know, high... Actually, I'm not sure what the color rate is for that, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be, you know, professional grade, high end, you know, 10 or 12 bits, so forth. So basically, if you want either a high end monitor to drive it, then you have some options. If you want to do a lot of compute, then you have some options. If you want to do high end professional graphics, you have some options. If you want to do all three, this guy. So, and if you look at the performance, it does beat, I believe, every single aspect of the Quadro K6000, which is NVIDIA's flagship.
Right.
Single precision, double precision. I mean, they're pretty close, but I believe AMD edges them out in both cases. Amount of onboard memory is significantly higher for AMD. NVIDIA tops it at 12 gigabytes per GPU. AMD says we're going 16, and with a bit more bus as well. They have a higher rating of open CL support. As far as I know, it's 1.2. There could end up being drivers for OpenCL 2.0. I don't think so, but the problem is they haven't been talking about it, and I don't want to say it won't if it does in the future, right? So safe to say 1.2, which NVIDIA's back at 1.1 still, which doesn't matter too much for most applications. There's some context sharing and other interesting features for the number of the type of operations you can do and other things like that. But it's the sort of things that if you aren't actually programming for the card, you look in the vendor box and being like, supports OpenCL 1.0. Okay, that's good, right? So it seems to edge out the NVIDIA competitor in everything that I can think of. Maybe not price and availability, because they haven't said anything about that yet. But apart from that, it seems to be, well, an R9 290X that got a job and maybe a haircut. Something I don't know much about.
No, I remember when I still, well, actually I have to get haircuts now. They just do it with a razor and not with an actual pair of scissors. You know, yeah. The 400-pound gorilla in the room we haven't mentioned. Something was very exciting about Game Developers Kit, or I should say the Game Developers GDC. The GDC last week was the Oculus Rift Development Kit 2. Announced it was going to be $350, expected in July. And then... what felt like minutes later, although it was actually like a day or two, was that I guess technically it was like 3 days later, 4 days later. Doesn't really matter. But the Facebook, of course, is buying Oculus Rift for $2 billion. And the internet went wild.
Yep, they lost their mind.
Yeah, there was a really great like Kotaku article that started tracing the rage and the anger, and then a lot of people just making really mild and reasonable comments on Twitter, you know, and everything from the "this is the problem with Kickstarter, we were the initial." It's funny, like in terms of payout, some people argued that if you had invested $300 to buy the original Oculus Rift dev kit, that your investment in a traditional venture capital environment might be worth $20,000. Now, other people pointed out that, hey, you kickstarted this project, you got a $300 developer's kit, and you're done. And it's very specifically, you know, lined up or laid out, or you know, if you read the fine print, it's pretty clear what a Kickstarter is and how it works. You know, it's But people have been going berserk. It's never going to ship. Yeah. It's been ruined. It's going to be the first virtual ad experience. Oh my goodness. What could have been amazing is going to be like the horrible scene in Minority Report where Tom Cruise is fighting off all of the ads that are customized to him because, you know, all of the advertising screens, machines, things in the mall he's walking through are queuing off of his retina, which give them their identity. Man, I was kind of amazed. Well, one, like everybody was all kind of like sitting around staring at the, staring like shocked. And it's funny, yeah. Like, you know, even with the announcement, we talked about a little bit about the announcement last week was that, you know what? VR is far from prime time. And what's interesting is that Facebook has a lot of money, a lot of motivation, a desperate desire to kind of sort of Google themselves into the next level of technology, maybe just so they don't become the next MySpace. And it's funny for a company that just spent $16 billion to buy their primary competitor in most of the world's emerging markets, a $2 billion purchase for a long-term payoff and what they consider sort of the next evolution of computing, maybe not that big a deal. Jeremy makes really good points. Oop, go ahead.
Also, we want to be careful to say $2 billion purchase. A lot of that is in stock, which can fluctuate wildly and so on and so forth.
$400 million in cash, you know, $1.6 billion in Facebook shares. Generally speaking, though, I think you will agree with me that the founders at Oculus Rift and the initial investors, which are probably walking out of this with the cash or equivalent stock of $380 million, the two primary major investors that came on board. You know, it's an interesting move. I'm really curious, you know, can Carmack be pushed around? Will Facebook screw it up? What does this mean for actual gaming? Does this mean we're going to have Farmville in 3D?
First off, there's two things I want to point out. First one is that this is the second time that Carmack was bought out by a company or a person that has a start with a Z. ZeniMax Zuckerberg. Anyway, but the more important thing is that even though they haven't really seemed to have thought of where they want to go with it, Oculus Rift is really good for gaming, but it is not necessarily all it can do. If you look at my situation, I'm sitting around five monitors right now. I have four kind of in a row, and I have one up there, which usually has, you know, video games and stuff like that.
Right.
That's a significant investment, and they're all completely miscalibrated and all that sort of stuff for the actual action of me being able to look around and have more screen real estate. If you can come up with a interface where you'll look like an idiot for the time being, but if you have a headset and wherever you look, it's an infinite amount of monitors, then, well, angle, if you can get high enough resolution, that can be compelling, and it might be something that a platform company might want to investigate in. There is a lot of ways they can take VR and AR, even though this is not really the case for Oculus, at least not in its current inception. But there is plenty of directions they can go.
Maybe they're bringing back Second Life.
And that's what people talk about too. It's like, oh, Second Life, where you can have, you know, 3D representation or PlayStation Home. And that's kind of cool, but novelty. But I mean, you don't necessarily need to. If you would have an infinite landscape desktop of monitor or whatever, which is AMOLED, high resolution, and 3D, you can do a lot of interesting things. I'm wondering where this could end up if someone stops and thinks, well, we got this technology. This would be cool to do with it, right? And they now have a lot of money and a lot of... I think it's more that Zuckerberg bought it because he thought it was cool. But there is a lot of ways it can go. And I think the best way to think about it at this point is to not think about what they're going to do or what they should do or whatever, but what is the spread of possibilities of what they can do.
Right.
And that is a very large set of items, right?
Yeah. And so, there's also, I mean, it's funny. Pardon me while I choke in front of you. I apologize. The, you know, it's also funny, like Cast AR is coming. Sony's dropped their hat in the ring. I don't think gaming and VR is dead.
Valve has their thing too.
And Valve has their thing, although Valve says they weren't really intending on productizing it. But who knows? Maybe they are. But
they kind of did, because the DK2 uses a bit of technology from Valve.
That's true.
They actually shared stuff around.
I agree, but it's not like Valve went to a Chinese manufacturer and did the contract and started physically building hardware. I mean, can you imagine the impact that Steam releasing VR hardware would have? I mean, after there were actually games available, or maybe for the Steam box.
And that's the thing that's kind of confused me too, is that probably about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, we had rumors of Apple, rumors of Google, mm-hmm. rumors of Valve, and rumors of Blanken, all going into mobile wearables and living room and content distribution all at the same time. So it's possible that the smart people in all these companies are being like, hey, we can merge all these technologies into this one unified experience for whatever purpose later on down the road. For the time being, it's going to look like we're developing four separate products, but maybe we're not, right?
It's all about virtual makeouts, dude, for the teenagers.
Yeah.
And, oh my goodness.
Thinking of Second Life, anyway.
Yeah, no, I was one of the second thing I thought after I read the announcement the third time. I was like, this is all about teenagers making out in 3D and virtual reality. And then I just got really... I went and took a shower. Twitch at twit.tv is the email address to reach us. We got some questions from the chat room tonight because they have been super active. We want to reward them for that. Mark T says, when's the new Corsair RGB LED keyboard coming out? This, of course, we saw at CES 2014. It is beautiful. It is all the Cherry Switch love that you could ever want. And it glows and it changes colors and you can custom map things and it's amazing. And Corsair has an exclusive on these 3mm keys, or these keys, period, these particular LED keys for 2014. So I'm assuming the keyboard is going to show up, in time for holiday shopping at the end of 2014, if not this summer. But as far as I know, no one, nowhere, no how has any exact information, Mark, on when this keyboard will ship.
I'm pretty sure Corsair said some stuff about target months.
Right.
But I can't remember exactly about it, and I could have gotten a couple announcements all mixed up in my head, but I think it's they have the exclusive for 2014. I think we're gonna start seeing it second half at some point, but I'm not sure roughly when. I think it's gonna be early in second half, actually.
That would be nice. But
I could have been thinking something else too. So
I think it's also one of those things where they want to get it right before it hits the street because they want it to be amazing. I mean, the demos we saw at CES were like, I laughed. Twitter was being mean to me yesterday because we posted a picture of that 4K gaming rig and I had my IBM Model M keyboard plugged into it. And it's really funny because I still think most mechanical switch keyboards are just trying to replicate, an experience that IBM perfected 30 years ago. I was mocked thoroughly for that, except for some serious keyboard enthusiast, one of whom who's not even out of college was just like, oh, where did you get that keyboard? And I'm like, I've got five of them in a box at home. Can I have one? Yes, you can have one. But the
something made funny. Yeah, Model M's.
Yeah.
Down actually I think like an hour or two away from Ryan where he lives down in Kentucky.
Oh, they're amazing keyboards. They're awesome. And that's why I have a box of them, because I basically wanted, two of them I figured would be a lifetime supply. Four or five of them would be a lifetime supply plus coffee problems. But it's funny, hopefully, second half, definitely by holiday buying season, unless something's gone wrong with the Switch production. But
now, The question is, how long is it going to take for someone to mess with the drivers so they can play Doom at its original resolution or whatever? With each pixel being a key.
About 20 minutes. I anticipate that showing up faster, sooner rather than later. But it's going to be really funny to see somebody with a keyboard staring at a keyboard playing Doom. It's just too frightening to even think about. McButterpants. Oh my goodness. McButterpants posts, Patrick, how long should a computer last these days? And I'm going to toss this one directly to Scott. How long do you think a computer should last these days?
You mean for it to not die? Well, how many cats do you have? there's many ways you can go about it. For gaming computer, I actually have a fairly strict life cycle. If you want to keep, you know, at maximum everything, if you want to keep ahead of everything, everything crank at the max, everything running 1080p, so on and so forth. Typically, what you want to do is you want to upgrade your computer every 4 years, right, and halfway through, upgrade the video card. So you have a video card every 2 years and the rest of the computer every 4 years. You might be able to extend that to 5 or 6 years and have it between 2 or 3 years for a time between. But that tends to be roughly the life cycle if you want to have everything cranked up at max 1080p. Now, how long is a computer going to last if you are browsing the internet and, you know, watching our podcast on repeat, which would be awesome.
Years. And years.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I know people hate to say it's like it's utility and that sort of thing, but they really are. But they're utilities that, it's not like you buy a hammer, then you buy a wrench. There is so many different types of computers for so many different types of applications. Going back to our story about the Tesla, Jetson TK1, we don't know what they're going to be used for in the future. So you might be able to find those devices, you know, stay in your car for 20 years and they will be able to drive the self-driving car unit or whatever for that amount of time.
What's so funny, right, is the car will still drive itself in 20 years. It just won't be able to play the latest generation of Netflix videos.
Yeah,
or you'll have to find somebody who's hacked, you know, a way for it to stream, you know, Pandora 2030 or 2050 or something like that. It's funny. Like, I love to get 5 years out of a computer, you know, desktop gaming machines, especially if you start going into bigger monitors, not going to happen. You know, the machine I use, that's kind of the general workspace machine that is used for typing and occasionally Netflix and mostly typing. And did I mention typing and doing stuff on the internet, controlling 3D printers and stuff like that? That thing could probably last 5 or 7 years. If if you update the operating system, you suddenly may think to yourself, it's time for a new GPU. It's time for, more memory. I mean, you know, it's ridiculous how cheap, it's not ridiculous, it's exciting how cheap SSDs are getting right now. You're looking at a nice quality 240 gigabyte SSD for $130 online right now. That's
a terabyte,
huge boost,
which is insane for, you know, 400 and change, right? So,
right.
430, wherever it is.
I used to build $500 gaming machines and try to get 5 years out of them. But in the course of 5 years, there would be at the very least a GPU change, the addition of more memory if I change the operating system. And, you know, it's getting kind of tough to hold out for a CPU change. You know, 5 years ago, you know, in 2000, if you waited 3 years, a new CPU would seem like the fastest thing in the universe. Today, it's more of an incremental increase. But, you know, if you wait 3 or 4 years between PCs, you're going to feel like you got your money's worth. If you replace your PC every year or 18 months, unless you're a really serious video editor or high-end gamer, you're just not going to feel the return in quite the same way.
The CPUs are getting a lot faster. And the CPUs are getting a lot faster. But the thing is, they're not getting a lot faster in single threads.
Yeah. And also just the whole problem with like 1080p screens are not very challenging to GPUs right now. You know what I mean? You don't need a $1,000 Titan to feed a 1080p screen. Like a $300 screen, you're starting to run out of options to turn up, at least for this generation of gaming.
And then you're thinking about, it's not hard to go and drive a 1080p screen. It's 2 megapixels. Not even 10 years ago, I was playing games at 640 by 40 or 800 by 600 because my video card was old or whatever. And I was fine with that. And now we're talking about 2 megapixels, which was, not even a digital camera territory at that point, right? People are like, oh, it has more than a megapixel? That's amazing, right?
it's nothing.
And that was a decade ago. And we're not even talking that long ago.
I will say 4K screens look amazing on your desktop. And oh my goodness, do they suck down every single pixel you can get out of your GPUs.
Yeah.
McT says, for a gaming laptop, Alienware 17-inch or Lenovo Y510P or other. And, when you're looking at gaming PCs, to me, you want to spend... I think of them as like the worst investment ever, because gaming PC GPUs tend to get their asses kicked in a relatively short period of time. The Lenovo, the Y510P, it's a nice Lenovo laptop. It starts at $800. You probably do not want to try gaming on the $800 one, because it's GT755M, and even if you get up to the $1,000 configuration, you're still looking at a GeForce GT755M. The Alienware gaming laptop is the 17 is starting at $1,500 and it's running a GTX 880M with 8 gigabytes of GDDR5. So for me, when you're looking at a gaming laptop, you're looking at how much you can get for the money you're spending, which will probably make you say, gosh, I shouldn't be looking at a Lenovo or an Alienware, although these are both great brands. They make nice laptops. You might want to be looking to figure out, if you think about everything other than sort of the motherboard, the memory, the GPU, and the quality of the screen, the rest of it's kind of fungible. and you may want to be looking at a brand you may be less familiar with. Some of the MSI laptops have done a pretty good job delivering gaming bang for the buck, but $1,000 to $1,500 is a pretty radical difference in performance, I think, for GPUs. I think you'd be happy with either one. I think the Alienware's got a little bit more going for it in terms of the graphics performance. I also am the first one to say, man, gaming machines are kind of the most disappointing hardware you can buy if you don't have the kind of money to buy one like every 2 years. I also will say that 17-inch laptops never sound ridiculously big until you're carrying one around. And if you're not carrying your gaming laptop around, spend the money, build a desktop PC, and you will kick the snot out of the gaming experience of the laptop for less money. That's just a fact.
That's kind of how it works too, right? So, there was talk, and this is one thing that's is kind of a fun rabbit hole to go down, but there was talk for like the last 10 years now of having dockable video cards. So you have a decent laptop, you stick it down, plug it in, and your monitors now have a crazy video card that was sitting on your desk the entire time. No one came to surf with it. I think I've seen a couple of them come to market.
Yeah.
By like a bunch of big companies. AMD was pushing it, as was Lucid, as was a couple of our small boutique places. There's reasons why people have been looking in that direction, but like you said, if you have a reason to go for a gaming laptop but it's not mobility, then chances are you don't have a reason to go for a gaming mobile laptop.
Right.
But the better question is, why would you want one?
So you can game on the plane with your car battery you're carrying with you, which will give you the plane ride worth of electricity you need.
Yeah. Although some of them have a plug now, which is,
Just saying.
Stuff. 110 volts, man. It's new technology.
I'm not even touching that one. Not even all the way across the internet. Scott, man, what's coming up on PC Per this week? What's got you excited that you're looking forward to?
Oh, man. Everyone's just kind of coming off of their various, you know, travel arrangements and their stuff like that. We're going to see just a lot more news. Ryan, then probably have stuff cooking, but probably a lot of news.
I think that's Scott's way of saying I'm under NDA and can't discuss the exciting developments. Nope. You'll be able to read about it. PC. Oh well.
I can't tell you right now. My last NDA just expired. You know, this week or something like that. So
okay.
I'm under NDA for anything. It's just. Everyone has been everywhere this day, and some people have projects going on, but I don't think anyone knows what anyone else is doing at this point. I don't deal with small businesses when you have everyone kind of independent contractor, right? Who knows what anyone else is doing, right?
I understand.
Everyone's busy. That's all we know.
And stories will show up. PCPro.com's website to find Scott's work. You can find me at techzilla.com or DIYTRYIN.com. We actually sent music via laser attached to a shark. The shark was unnecessary, but sending music over lasers with amplitude modulation was kind of a hoot. We have a lot of fun with that one. And that's it for this episode of Twitch. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Scott Michaud.
We'll see you next week.